Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan, and the author of Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls. If you'd like a signed copy, you can order one from the Margate Bookshop. They deliver nationwide. Today's guest is the writer and critic Olivia Lang. I fell in love with her words when I read 2016's The Lonely City, a meditation on solo living, New York, and the artists who have lost and found themselves there. Since then, Olivia has published the Sunday Times bestseller Crudo, a fictionalised real-time account of the summer of 2017, and an essay collection, Funny Weather, Art in an Emergency. Her new book, Everybody, a book about freedom, uses the life of the psychoanalyst Wilhelm Reich to explore the body as a site of pleasure and pain. We talked about Dickens, cancel culture, and how her husband's passion for the works of Jilly Cooper ended up in the Daily Mail. I know you have given many, many interviews about your wonderful book, Funny Weather, and about the function of art in hard times. I would love to ask you about the books that you turned to during our year of hard times.
The best thing I read, actually, was Bleak House by Dickens, which I suddenly realised that I did not know very much about 19th century literature. And obviously everyone loves Dickens, and Dickens is amazing, and maybe I should pick it up. And the reason everyone loves Dickens is because he's bloody amazing. It was totally brilliant and so sort of apposite for a plague year. It's all full of infection and quarantine, and somebody gets the pox and has to lock herself in a room. And there are all these scenes that felt so sort of resonant to read in the first lockdown. And there were scenes that sort of stayed with me, and scenes that were heartrending, and language that stayed with me. So Dickens was absolutely my best lockdown read.
And was there anything specific that really led you to that book? Or was it just one of those, it's not going anywhere, one day I'll read it, and one day was 2020?
I think actually, so my husband was a Cambridge Don and has read every single book ever written. And, you know, I feel various sort of strands of guilt and shame about the things I hadn't read. And at the beginning of, what year are we in now, 2021? So New Year's Eve 2019, I said, well, I'm going to read 12 19th century novels over the course of the year, not really obviously realising what kind of year it was going to be. So I did peter out after a few, but I read Middlemarch and I read Bleak House. I read a bit more Dickens. And I read all the Jane Austens that I hadn't read. So I was on a sort of project anyway. But Bleak House was just one of those magical sort of coincidings of the subject matter resonated so much with what was happening in the world. Dickens' kind of fury about what happens to the poor felt so resonant as well. So it just really came alive for me.
I'm ashamed about how little Dickens I've read. And I think maybe the secret is to think, well, no, I must read him because he is wonderful, and not to sort of resent it as further homework.
It's just not homework. It really rockets along, and the characters are hilarious and the jokes are still funny, and it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm doing something really worthy now, I'm reading my Dickens. It felt like, please could everyone stop talking in this room because I need to read my Dickens.
Because I'm always surprised by his humour and how it is still funny, and funny for the same reasons, I imagine. Not that I was, you know, around in the 19th century being amused by things. But I think Bleak House is my dad's very, very favourite. And My problem with it is just that it's called Bleak House, which doesn't entice me.
But Bleak House, I thought this too. I thought Bleak House was a really bleak house, but it turns out Bleak House is actually like the most lovely, warm, comfortable house, and the name is a joke. So if somebody had told me that, I might have read it earlier.
I believe you mentioned your very well-read husband. I think we have both been on the same podcast together. I think we're both on the Jilly Cooper episode of Backlisted, talking about Imogen, which is far from
my
bleak
favorite
house.
Book.
Is it really?
I got him into, it was me that made him read Jilly Cooper after his wife before me, Jenny Diske, died. So I feel very responsible for his late life love affair with Jilly Cooper, which now happens in reality because they adore each other and send each other valentines.
Oh, God, so they have a correspondence.
They're friends. They became really good friends.
As a result of his late in life reading?
He wrote an appreciation of her for the LRB, and which might be before that podcast. And that got taken up by, you know, the Daily Mail were going, Cambridge, lovelorn, or heartbroken Cambridge Don finds new lease of life reading Jilly Cooper. And she read all of these pieces and then read the original LRB piece and was absolutely bowled over by how seriously he'd taken her truly amazing books, which deserve to be read that seriously, and then invited us over and we all became friends and she was the nicest person alive.
This is wonderful. This is making my heart swell. It makes me so happy. And again, in a way, I suppose she's probably really doing, I think, something very similar to Dickens in a different way, where she's talking about what is going on socially and observing people and being quite waspish and quite critical when the occasion calls for it. But also, I think, being, she sees what people do. She judges people on their behaviour.
And she has those enormous castes of all sort of levels of class and rural castes and urban castes. And she's very good at kind of satirising how people behave. She's sort of like Trollope, and she's a lot like Jane Austen as well. I just think Jilly Cooper is criminally underrated in this country. She's such an interesting and funny and beady writer. She's so intelligent about how people behave.
I agree. I've been in moments of insomnia. I've been rereading The Man Who Made Husbands Jealous lately. And the...
Oh, Lysander.
I think he's my favourite because Rupert Campbell-Black is just horrible. And I think the more...
No! This is wrong!
Not horrible, but you know, I think when I was a wide-eyed teenager, I thought, you know, yes, that's the man for me. And now I think, oh no, Lysander's just so properly kind.
He's a bit wet. Oh. I'd rather have Rupert. There's a brilliant scene where Rupert grabs somebody a bread roll, butters it and puts salt on it and goes, eat that. And I always think that's just the most romantic, brilliant scene.
I do know Jilly a very tiny bit. I've been very, very lucky and had the pleasure of her company a couple of times. And we're both Pisces. We are both quite wet. So I think that Lysander is possibly her, maybe everyone thinks he's a little bit wet, but she's very fond and I'm very fond. But I don't want to assume anything of the queen of my literary heart. But tell me about the Jane Austen that you were rereading, and just had Claire Chambers on the podcast, but that she went back and read Persuasion, I think, having not really enjoyed it very much the first time around, being quite dismissive of it, but glad that she went back for another crack.
That was the one I hadn't read that I was just bowled over. I think that's the best one. It's such a autumnal, melancholy, kind of seasoned book, and it makes you wish that she had lived longer and had written more, because you think it's going somewhere so different from Pride and Prejudice. It's just getting more and more sober. And also, when you read them in middle age, you realise you read them as romances when you're young, and when you return to them and you're older, you see all of these characters around the edges that are funny but also very poignant. And there's a lot of the older women and the kind of constricted lives that they have, or the irritating fathers that you hadn't quite grasped were as beautifully portrayed in their irritatingness as they are. And I could just read those books over and over forever, really.
And that
the ache of being let down and bravely making the best of things and only being able to face up to a life not being quite as you hoped or deserved, but sort of but by degrees.
And the obsession with property is actually an obsession with survival and women's lives being so dependent on what they're given or what they're left or what they can marry into, and that those tensions actually being sort of violent and terrifying despite being described in this, you know, card games and tea and benign way, actually the forces and the precipices and the falls are very powerful within that world. They're very dramatic, but it's contained in this amazingly restrained, dignified way. So I went back and read Jane Eyre the other day as well, and I thought, Jane Eyre is awful, I can't bear her. I like the Jane Austen people who've got some dignity about them.
I think as a younger reader, and I'm the eldest of six girls, I've got five younger sisters, and I felt that Jane Austen was much more sort of stylish, and there was something below the surface, and Jane Eyre seemed a lot more kind of all passion and tantrums and everything that I was, you know, warned off and told not to be and told not to sort of set a bad example. And I think I always kind of resented her for that, for her, you know, even though she's sort of this amazing, wild, captivating woman, you know, carving out a life from barely anything. But it's like I really love Henry James and that sort of this very kind of sexy idea, I think, that, you know, nothing can be said, but everything is thought. And, you know, what does the raise of an eyebrow mean? Or is that sort of, you know...
Constraint, basically. Constraint is very... Well, it's a middle-aged pleasure, because I definitely read Jane Eyre for the first time and thought, oh, she's saying everything, she feels so much. It's such a teenage girl emotional landscape. But going back to it, it's like, oh, Jane, do shut up. Control yourself. I felt sympathy for Aunt Reed. Just come on, get a grip.
What were you reading as a young woman, as a teenager?
Derek Jarman, lots of Serpent's Tale books, Kathy Acker, lots of American countercultural stuff, William Burroughs obsessively, but also Ginny Cooper. So I had multiple strings to my reading bow.
I always thought that if I took up roller derby, which I think is the way you have to pronounce it because it's an American sport, that I would be Kathy Smacker. Kathy
good.
Smacker or Nasty Mitford.
They're both really good. You should take it up, just have the name.
I know, I think I'd die in about 15 seconds, but I'd have a great name. How did you meet Kathy Acker? Because I think I was so late to her, and what a brilliant writer to have as a teenager. I feel like she's who a teenage girl really needs.
I think I had a cousin who was a decade older than me, and she used to sort of pass me on, you know, little birthday parcels of those sort of writers, those kind of American writers. And they were the perfect thing to read when you're that sort of age. Now, I was involved in Riot Girl and I was making fanzines in my bedroom. And so that sort of writing really spoke to me. It was very much part of that sort of 90s culture anyway.
I've read reviews of Crudo where, you know, that sort of that link is made sort of to Kathy Acker. And it's one of those things where I admit I didn't initially see it, and then as soon as someone else did, I was like, oh yes, of course, you know, that sort of, I can really, you know, hear the texture of it. And the, in a way, it's sort of the opposite and the same as Jane Austen, because that there's no restraint, but I think it comes from all of the same structures that make you feel a certain way. And it's like, this is what I have to hide, and this is what I really want to say.
I love that, because she is like a counterculture version of Jane Austen. She is talking about the same structures and the same sort of deforming apparatus that affects women's lives, but her way of approaching it is this really punk, cut up, I'm going to take all of these great works of literature and I'm just going to appropriate them. I'm going to start, you know, stealing Great Expectations by Dickens, but put it in the first person and make it the story of Kathy Acker. So that sort of grabbing hold of great works of 19th century literature and, you know, using it to tell a story about what women's lives are like and what they could be like, and to sort of lay that bare, feels like it's Jane Austen gone rogue.
So I was not in part of Riot Girl in any meaningful way. I was just being a sad girl in her bedroom reading Sleeve Notes, but I did read Sleeve Notes like they were books, I think, really before I read any poetry of my own volition.
I think that it's so easy to forget that moment when you're in your mid-teens and you actually know so little about the world and you know so little about art and literature. And music for me was just the gateway into everything. Like, a band I loved would mention a writer they liked and I'd go off and read that writer. I remember reading Salinger for the first time because a band called Ride liked Salinger and talked about them in Melody Maker, and I was like, oh, Salinger, okay, I'll look him up. You know, and then it just opens up more and more. It's that sort of pass the parcel thing that art can do for you. And I would read lyrics and be like, wow, these lyrics are so great, and they wouldn't be great at all. Or sometimes they would be. I mean, some of them definitely stayed with me, but it was more just that it was a sort of route into a more adult world of things that I then discovered that perhaps were better or more exciting. But that was the secret door that opened.
I think there always has to be a gateway drug, doesn't there? And I think that it's really important to remember that you know, all of these paths lead to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, that there are so many different ways through, and odd little suggestions that a person makes or something. I mean, you know, I grew up, it sounds like you did too, pre-internet, and it really was like listening out for signals and clues and codes. And if somebody said something, you sort of had to follow it up, or somebody mentioned a club and you had to kind of find out what it was. And there wasn't a way that you could sort of just access all the information. So in a way, that makes you a reader as well, doesn't it? Because you're having to pay attention all the time. The teenage reader of that era was so invested and so active. It's not passive reading at all.
Absolutely. And a perma battle I've had with any of my editors who are lovely and amazing and wonderful is about making references to things that people may not have heard of. And oh gosh, who was it? That was it. I was having lunch with a friend who was talking about her book and the sort of making it something that American readers might be interested in. And I think her editor was sort of going through and trying to make it relevant to Americans. And there's a bit where she talks about Michael Havers, and the editor said, no English people know who Nigel Havers is anymore. Heaven help the Americans.
Oh, no, come on, they can look it up.
Quite, and just, there are so many, all books yeah. educated me by context. You know, I didn't know what anything was, but that the books were my internet, you know, as those little references to obscure yeah. things that I could sort of figure out and sometimes get hilariously wrong.
There's an amazing thing in T.H. White's The Once and Future King, which is a book about King Arthur, you know, King Arthur, that I remember reading when I was a child, and he's with Merlin and he describes the experience of Merlin sort of talking and him not really understanding, as following along like a dolphin in the wake. And I just love that. That's like, it's the opposite of you should understand everything in advance. You're sort of prancing and leaping around joyously, knowing that there's so much more that you're yet to understand, but you're grasping little fragments of it. And that feels to me like the right approach when writing. It's like, it doesn't matter if people don't know everything, and you don't have to introduce every character in this sort of earnest way. That people, if they're excited enough, will look it up, or will look up some of it. So I always feel like it's much better to aim high and trust that your readers are intelligent and intuitive and you know, entrepreneurial about gathering information, rather than spoon feeding them with information that they're then bored by anyway.
It's so true. And I love that, the image of the water and the sort of the kinetic energy of, you know, waves going over your head and just carrying you along, that you will just throw yourself into it and you see what you see, and then, you know, go back and reread and reimmerse and revisit, and everything becomes a tiny bit clearer to you. I guess a lot like so much visual art. Are there any novels with art storylines that you love? I always think of Siri Hisvet, What I Loved.
I'm generally slightly embarrassed by novels about art, I think. I love reading art criticism, and I love reading criticism generally that uses artworks. I love reading books by artists, I love memoirs by artists, but novels sort of set in the art world always feel like they get things wrong, or they miss the point slightly. I mean, I don't think I'm a massive fan of contemporary fiction anyway, but no, it's probably not my bag.
I'd love to hear about memoirs written by artists and biographers that you have found especially illuminating or provocative or entertaining.
I mean, Derek Jarman is always one of my go-to artists who is also a magnificent writer. So, you know, he wrote Modern Nature, which is his diary about building the garden at Dungeness, but he also he wrote a fantastic book called Chroma, which is like a meditation on colour. And, you know, he had AIDS, he was going blind. And he started writing this book about a life spent immersed in colour and just thinking about what all the different colours meant, what sort of emotional resonance they had, what paintings he loved, like Caravaggio's Scarlets, the sort of different ways that he'd seen those colours in art history or in nature. And it's just the most beautiful, strange, meandering book. You can lose yourself in it. And that feels to me much more like it has the texture of art than something that's sort of set more concretely in an art world.
I think that makes sense. I suppose quite often art is used as a device. It expresses themes of power and money and the absurd, as well as, or, you know, or better than, you know, many other industries. And I guess in a book it's so often used as a way of sort of, you know, giving people power and taking people power, and there are quite, you know, thrilling machinations around it, but that has very little to do with the actual experience of looking at art itself.
That's probably true, yeah. And maybe that, I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, I really love Patricia Highsmith's Talented Mr. Ripley novels, the whole series of the Ripley novels, and there's a thread in that that's all about art forgery. There's after the first one, where Ripley has to kill his first friend and take on his identity, he then gets involved in a forgery project. And that always felt to me like it was really accurate about the art world and kind of really fascinating and knowledgeable and done with the right sort of lightness of touch, that it didn't feel like, oh, I'm writing a serious novel about art. I don't know. It was very pleasurable for me to read.
Any writer, especially a writer of fiction, who can do that research and have that depth of knowledge but be sparing with it. I think so often I read things where I feel the detail is gratuitous. I laboured, I sat and I researched and researched and researched, and you need to know this too. And you're like, do I though?
There's a brilliant, there's an amazing line. I was, when I was writing The Trip to Echo Spring, I was going through John Cheever's papers and I found this handwritten thing where he was writing, I'm sorry, this is about Henry James, who I also like, but anyway, it's funny about Henry James. And he said, you can hear him as he's rushing, carrying the tea tray from room to room, audibly panting. He's trying so hard. And I just thought, oh, God. The audibly panting has stayed with me in everything I've ever written afterwards. No panting,
oh,
please.
It's mean, but that's brilliant. When do you go and research, or this is a really stupid question, but what's that experience of going through these papers like? Is it sort of a tactile exercise? Like, how do you kind of get to the vaults? Do you have favourite libraries and favourite places?
Well, I love the BL. I can't wait to get back into my Humanities One reading room. But when I'm working on specific people, it's wherever their archive is, so... Yeah, I absolutely love it. I worked in the Andy Warhol archive for a while, and it's so intimate. If you're working on artists in particular, I mean, writers are good, but artists are even better because they tend to have all kinds of artifacts. So you're like, you know, looking at people's wallets and passports and stuff that they've really handled, and then that's very moving. And with Warhol, it was like his wigs with a tiny bit of a sweat stain in them, and just, it's really moving. It really gives you a sense of the missing person, and I find that very inspiring when I'm writing about somebody.
I do. This is the cheesy and grating bit. It's probably good that we've got the video off, but I do, the Lonely City, that is the writing about Warhol that I have most engaged with and most enjoyed, and I felt most had a sense of a human.
Oh, it's all because of the wigs. The wigs unlocked the man.
I'm always alarmed and fascinated by how, what he was doing and what he presented, and the way he presented himself has only ever become more and more and more and more relevant. And this idea of sort of sending yourself up and making a caricature of yourself was also, I guess, some of the earliest branding as we know it contemporaneously.
That's really interesting, because it sort of looks retrospectively like he was branding himself, but I think actually he was making an Andy Warhol to hide behind, because he was so shy, and because he so struggled with who Andrew Warhol was, this sort of sickly boy, gay, wanted to conceal all sorts of elements of his identity. And so he makes a instantly recognisable caricature persona, and that is absolutely what branding people do. And he worked in advertising before he became an artist, so he was very adept at making, you know, the image that will sell and the image that will go through the world and be successful and be liked. And it really cuts to the heart of how we are now as well in the 21st century, that we're all doing that all the time. You know, we're building our brands and we're curating our identities. And Warhol was like, yeah, I did that a long time ago.
But as you say, it's not just about self-aggrandizement at all. It's about hiding. And I think now we are all so exposed, and I think we're all put on so much, under so much pressure, kind of voluntarily expose ourselves. And a brand isn't just about saying, look at me, here I am, buy my thing, like me, I need the numbers. But it's a sort of, you know, a handy carapace. We all need one.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially because we're all living our lives in public. And these days we're not even in public, we're in private in public. That sort of sense that there's been a complete erosion of the boundary between the two. And you do in a way need that sense of a branded identity to just feel like there's some sense that there's a private world that isn't shared, that is kind of sacrosanct, that, you know, everyone talking from their bedrooms has felt immensely exposing this year.
It's true. And I think that weird pressure, the tension and the contradictory forces of, I think we all feel as though we have disappeared, that everything's gone, the markers have gone. And so we're sort of, I think we have had access to an easy and cheap and dangerous means of making sure that we remain seen should we choose to use it, and maybe made decisions that we wouldn't have made if we hadn't all been at home alone and locked up.
Yeah, and I think there's something as well about, one of the things that I really miss about being in public or talking in public is that you can just say things, you know, into the moment, into the air of the moment, into the ears of other people, but it's not recorded, it's not there in perpetuity. And I think all of these conversations that are sort of endlessly being recorded and broadcast and stored, and there's a sense of, you know, you have to be so careful, you have to be thinking so carefully about whether what you're saying is right for multiple other unimaginable contexts in which it might be heard. And I think that feels very perilous to people. You know, we're in a sort of social media atmosphere anyway that's very adversarial and very sort of critical and heated. And I think that plus the collapse between public and private has felt really scary lately.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We'll be back to Olivia soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, Mary Jane by Jessica Anya Blau. 14-year-old Mary Jane lives in one of the smarter suburbs in Baltimore. An only child with repressive parents, Mary Jane sings in the church choir, listens to musical soundtracks, and hasn't been allowed to so much as go to a rock concert. Then she gets a job as a nanny for the neighbours, the Cones. They're glamorous, messy bohemians. Even more glamorous is Dr. Cone's new patient, a rock star hoping to be cured of his addiction, who's moving to Cone's house with his movie star wife. This is funny, tender, giddy and sad. The vibe is Daisy Jones and the Six meets Gigi Bloom. There's a collision of light and dark as Mary Jane has her heart opened while she's forced to confront her parents' prejudices. It's a perfect summer novel, but it will stay with you for long after the light fades. Mary Jane by Jessica Anya Blau is published by HarperCollins and out now. Now, back to Olivia. And I suppose, you know, we look at people from the past. I was thinking about Warhol, but I'm sure plenty of the people that we've mentioned already would not survive in this climate and in this culture. And there are plenty of sort of cultural figures I love that I do find it harder to love now. And I hate that. I really wish I wasn't so sort of emotional and histrionic. And it's quite teenagery of me, I think, my need to like people.
I think also there's something about a refusal of history that people weren't operating in the world that we're operating in now. They weren't operating by the same standards. And to try and judge people's personal lives by contemporary standards feels actually quite violent in itself. People emerge out of circumstance and circumstance changes and different kinds of people emerge. And that endless need to sort of find perfect people and for people to be pure, great artists, but also pure lives, just it feels very immature to me. It doesn't feel particularly realistic. And, you know, I've spent a career working on difficult artists, many of whom have done quite hateful things, but have also made work that is full of liberatory possibilities, full of excitements and full of useful information for any of us. And you've got to allow people to be both. You've got to allow people to have the full range of possibility and experience, because that is the nature of the world. It is like that. And I think there's a difference between calling out injustice and actually just blanket hysterical discarding of artists from 100 or 200 years ago because they did something that you don't much like by the standards of a century they didn't live in.
Do you have a preferred biographer of Warhol or someone who you think has done the most comprehensive writing around him, other than yourself?
No, I'm really into primary sources. I mean, there are definitely occasions where I think the biography, like the Virginia Woolf biography by Hermione Lee, is mind-blowingly magnificent. But when it comes to Warhol, I was much more interested in his writing and in the memoirs of people in his circle, you know, even if they're sort of overblown, drug-fueled and kind of unreliable. That felt to me like reading lots and lots of those got me much closer to the texture of his life than reading any sort of overarching biography. And the same with pretty much anyone else that I've worked on. That tends to be the way that I go, is trying to find as much first-person recollection. And also, Warhol had written, like, what, the world's largest diary. I mean, it's not quite, but it's a doorstopper. And book after book after book. So he's a very eloquent kind of chronicler of his own times anyway. And that was what I relied on, really. I like people speaking in their own voices.
There's a line from his diaries that I think about at least once a week, about Norman Mailer punching someone at a party. And he says, Norman Mailer was the only intellectual I ever really admired. I think, I can't remember if Norman Mailer punches someone wearing a pink shirt or someone makes a remark about Norman Mailer's pink shirt, so he gets punched. But
my favourite bit is when he fires somebody's dogs. Fame and fortune will be fired. Yeah, I love Andy Warhol. It's an amazingly funny book. And also, if you're writing, I was writing a piece about Trump once, and I was like, I wonder if Andy Warhol met Trump. And you go through the index, which is thousands of pages long, and everybody's there. So any time you're writing any sort of biographical work, like Warhol clocked it, Warhol watched it, and generally has something very beady to say about it as well.
Did you read Tina Brown's Vanity Fair diaries?
No, I still haven't.
I understand that they're so accurate and good, and she remembers so much because she doesn't drink.
Oh no! It's very dangerous for all the people that do when one person doesn't and has a good memory.
And I think, you know, gosh, do you live it or do you chronicle it?
Well, Warhol was clever because he rang his secretary every morning and did his over the phone to her. So she was writing down what he was saying and he's just kind of chatting, which is why it sounds so great, because it's all sort of his real spoken voice.
Oh, that would be, I don't know if you could do an anthology or something, but about the role of the phone in sort of mid to late 20th century novels and otherwise. I was thinking about Dorothy Parker, yeah, and how good she is on a phone conversation.
I love people getting down how people actually talk. I always find that really exciting. There's a novel called Talk that just does that, and it's so brilliant. And obviously Andy Warhol's A is just people talking, completely unmediated conversations. It's just tape recorded conversations, and it's fascinating. And then it's so boring, just like people's phone conversations are.
I don't think I know Talk. Who's the author?
I can't remember, and I can't see a copy from where I'm sitting. It's got a nice yellow cover, and it was republished by New York Review of Books maybe 5 years ago. It's a 60s book, though.
That sounds great fun. I'm sure we can find it in the show notes. Some of the best books I've read over the last year, I think, have been those New York Review reissues.
They do really good things. And then they make them look so beautiful as well. They've always got really lovely covers.
Are there any books that you have loved, you'd love to see reissued? Anything from the backlist that you've tracked down and you think deserves a new audience?
I'm really into Golden Age detective novels, and I don't know that they've all been reissued. Josephine Tay, Marjorie Allingham, all of those people. I suppose they sort of tick along in, you know, whatever jackets they've got, but I feel like those sort of very sharp-eyed women from before the war and then between the wars are just brilliant. Everyone should read them.
That's so weird, because I'd never heard of Josephine Tay, but Claire Chambers. But she said that she was a charity shop discovery or something, or something that she couldn't sort of get hold of, you know, as a new book. But, you know, I think that's really interesting as well, the way women observe that between the war period as well.
All of that social change, all of that social unease, and especially the ones just after the Second World War, that the kind of massive shifts in people's lives and massive shifts in class movement, and how, you know, the sort of container of the detective novel that's so conservative anyway is trying to manage those anxieties is really fascinating. Again, it's a thing where you don't have to like it. You don't have to like it politically or morally to find it very, very interesting and opening up of a period that, you know, in some ways is really close to us.
Because I guess, as I think we're probably about to find out now, we think of the wars as being these sort of units of disaster. And then everything was fine. And then there was economic prosperity in the 60s, and that was jolly.
Actually, the 50s were so bleak, I think. I'm really interested in reading about that. I've just been, this already has been reissued, but the Len Deighton books are just so gripping about that period where it's like it's not quite the sunny uplands of the 60s, and there's so much damage still from the war, and there's so much poverty still from the war. And they're completely fascinating to sort of lean back into that period.
I don't know those, but I would love to read them. Are they novels? Are they fiction? Or are they sort of historical books about
them? Yeah, this is like the Ipcress File and Horse Underwater and those books. But then I was they've all just been brought out by Penguin with, you know, glamorous graphic design new covers. And the one that I've just read is SSGB, which is this amazing counterfactual imagining of the Germans having won the Battle of Britain. And so it's a detective story, and your detective is in Scotland Yard, but he's working under a Nazi government, and there's all sorts of uprisings and resistance, but he's just doing his job trying to solve a murder. But the conditions are completely other, and there's this sort of Unheimlich eeriness about everything, because, you know, you've got Nazi flags down Oxford Street, and there are, you know, all of the ruins of the Nazis having fought their way up from the coast to London, and Croydon is a desperate wreckage of bomb sites. And it's just, oh my God, it's such a magnificent book. I think it's been made into a TV series, which is very exciting.
I bet that could be, you know, done in a really sort of visually arresting way. I can't bear a lot of future dystopias, but a past dystopia, I think I'd find that weirdly uplifting. Look what didn't happen.
Yeah, that's true, actually. For once you can put the book down and be like, it's definitely not that bad. And it's probably not going to happen either, so we can be really relaxed about it.
Oh, I think I might have to give that one a read. Cheer me up. Because I suppose we don't know yet. And there was a real rush, I think, the sort of, you know, the pandemic, you know, what's the pandemic fiction going to be? You know, I dread to think. I've just been finishing a novel, trying to write that and sort of saying, well, if anyone asks, it's set at the beginning of 2019, because I just couldn't go and be in an imagined world that was now, and I had to live in the now, and the sort of, and also not yet being able to capture the rhythms of life accurately, and really not wanting to have every other, like, and they got in and they put on their mask and they took off their mask and they put on the...
Oh, there's going to be so much of that, I think, in the novels of next year. I think we're going to be awash with it. I'm dreading it, yeah. But I mean, there'll be something that's fantastic about it, but I mean, there'll be a book that's fantastic in it, but I think sometimes you need to have a lot of ground between you and that kind of event to have clarity about what's actually happened or what it meant.
Are there any quiet books you love, or do you tend to reach for things with sort of broader, bigger, wider themes?
I think I like sidelong books, really. I don't like a sort of potted narrative of anything. What I want is to come in through a different doorway, and I think that's why memoirs can be so interesting, or people's life stories have a sort of slant view on larger scenes of history. Or, you know, if we're talking about autofiction, when the book that really underpinned Crudo wasn't the sort of contemporary autofiction, it was Christopher Isherwood's Goodbye to Berlin, which I think is just such an amazing book about the moment just before war, the moment when Weimar Berlin turns into Hitler's Berlin. And, you know, he's starting off this book, which is total autofiction. Christopher did this, Christopher did that. And he's starting off with this sort of slightly overexcited, really, well, you know, I'm in love with Berlin and all these romantic friendships and the Sally Bowles character. And, you know, it's all very glamorous. And gradually, you know, he's seeing swastikas out of the corner of his eye, or he's seeing brown shirts beating somebody up. And there's this sense of, this is how what happens. It doesn't just suddenly happen. It's creeping its tendrils into daily reality. And yet the reality is still daily. And I think, you know, now we've been through this experience of a pandemic, I think we've all had that experience of, you know, it's a question that you think about academically of, like, what is it like when a crisis befalls your life, and does your life just become about the crisis? But actually, of course, you carry on with your daily life as well, and your daily concerns and the petty things and the global enormous things interplay and are involved with each other. And that Goodbye to Berlin just captures that so fantastically well. You know, if there's a pandemic novel that is as good as that, then I can't wait to read it.
I think that's so interesting, because of course he doesn't wake up, here I am in Nazi Germany again. It's day
and
whatever.
Now I'm a war reporter and I'm telling you a war reporter. I mean, no, he's still him, and he's still got his own, you know, interests and obsessions, and those things loom as large as what's going on outside. You know, we're all selfish, aren't we? We're all engaged in our own lives very deeply. And at the same time, you know, if it's the COVID story, then the body counts are going higher and higher. But at the same time, you're still doing what you were doing and having a fight with your friend and being like, look at this email, isn't it awful?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's where tenderness comes from. And I think that's sort of how we arouse it in each other. Because as you say, we're not meditating on the dreadful statistics, or maybe we are to a point until we can't take it anymore. I suppose it's like the loo roll thing, isn't it? Of the being perhaps sort of academically upset, or, you know, aware of the tragedy, thinking, you know, it's so dreadful, it's all so awful. But then really, you know, feeling moved to sort of violent distress by not being able to buy loo roll.
It's funny, at the beginning of that, I was like, why are we talking about loo roll? And then I remembered, because I'd forgotten that bit of the pandemic already. And then I remembered buying Tampax and being like, oh my God, they're price gouging on Tampax. I've just paid £25 for... And I'd forgotten that bit of it, because, you know, it's moved on. We're so far away from those first couple of months where people were stockpiling loo roll. So I'm going to need the pandemic novel to remind me of these scenes.
And that's the funny thing, isn't it? I suppose that, you know, people urging each other to keep diaries, and if there'll be any kind of mass observation style recording of it, and what we will forget, and how, you know, I'm finding now, I read the Cazalet Chronicles at the very beginning of lockdown. I sort of binged them back to back.
Well, that's perfect for exactly the same thing, that feeling of ordinary life being very, very gradually invaded by war. Going off to buy the blackout curtain material. I mean, all those things.
And, you know, them sort of thinking about how, you know, the bits of the house that could sort of be, you know, be converted for refugees and things, and that they're sort of, they're making do by, rather than having a separate Thai tea for the grown-ups and the children, they all sort of towards the end of it have got to go in at once. But definitely feeling like, oh, you know, gosh, I've I've got nothing to complain about here, you know, what they had to go through. And then thinking, but Edward can go to the bloody pub.
Yeah. They could still socialise. I mean, I do think it was much worse, but those books are also being turned into a new TV show, I just heard.
Ah, that's interesting.
By the people who did Killing Eve, which seems promising. Did you read all the way through? Did you read all of them?
I did.
It's my personal belief that the last one should be destroyed and no one should ever read it, because I think she makes up this wonderful world and it's all very, very complicated and detailed, and in the last one she just destroys everybody and it's unbearable.
Did I read the last one? There are five. Gosh, it's awful.
Maybe you didn't.
Maybe.
Don't.
So I got as far as...
Did Polly get married?
Yes. And she's...
Yes, stop there.
Sort of in the big house.
The big house that's... Is it full of Rembrandts? Do they find like 35 Rembrandts in the attic?
They're saved.
That's my favourite twist in literature. Oh look, there are 35 Rembrandts in the attic, we're saved.
We've never seen these before. It is like a sort of predating Storage Wars. Fancy that.
Oh, I love those books.
I have just started reading a writer called Denton Welsh.
Yeah.
But I love his fascination, sort of like objet d'art, and even as a very young man, just being sort of obsessed with going out and getting antiques and things. And that Polly and Clary are the same, and I love it because I'm so sort of avaricious and ignoble, and I love things and I love stuff, and I love novels where people are allowed to get excited about stuff.
I love the stuff in novels. I love the furniture in novels. But Anthony Pohl is brilliant on that as well. Actually, he's a great writer about artists and the art world, but he's always full of stuff, and people's houses have got the right kind of furniture in. And those sort of novels you can live in because you can walk in your mind back into the rooms and think, you know, this is what they're eating their tea on, and this is what they're sitting on. And I love that. I love to feel that things are properly furnished.
Yes, and I always get a bit of a pole vibe from Anita Bruckner, who I adore. But that sense of things being a little claustrophobic and a little overheated, and when furniture is just slightly too big for a room, and when something is, you know, well done and comfortable and you can sort of relax into it. And then just sometimes that's like when things are either a little bit too new or too shabby and everything is really just sort of shoved in. Both, I think, novelists who make me want to kind of open a window and I can smell a bit of stale gravy somewhere. But I think that's a hell of a thing to evoke.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the level. I mean, I'm interested in the characters, but those sort of things as well, I'm always so fascinated by and so enjoy kind of stopping and pausing and imagining what exactly they're describing or what they're conveying. Rosamund Lehman is very good at that, Invitation to the Waltz and The Weather in the Streets. That some of the rooms that she describes, you just, well, unpleasant ones and pleasant ones, they really feel so real, so tangible.
If you could live in a fictional house, or, you know, go and stay there for a fortnight or something, where would you go?
I capture the castle, but not the weird house where they don't have any food, but the Elizabethan house where they go and listen to music and eat really lovely. Do they have roast
where
duck?
Simon and...
Yeah. Yes, Simon can sort of, I'll have the house. That feels so real to me. That there are so many houses from childhood stories. Green Knowe as well always feels very... Well, it is a real house, but it feels real in my mind as well.
I mean, something I do think about a lot in I Capture the Castle is Rose and the towels. And but I suppose the way she is supposed to be sort of a terrible, calculating, you know, villain who... But it's really, you know, not... It's the same as sort of, you know, what Jane Austen was writing about, really. And to be that sense of everything being so stretched and cramped and... Everything being just a sort of source of anxiety, and all it takes is a towel that is dry and soft after you've had a shower to think, you know, with God as my witness, I'm never going back to the damp again.
Yeah, absolutely. But also the sense that the only kind of agency you've got, or the only power you've got to make a different decision, is marriage. And it's funny, that book. It's so light, but then you can reread it and reread it as an adult, and there's so much going on in it. It's so perfectly pitched. It feels, you know, as we're talking, I can imagine walking down the lane with the dog, or I can imagine sitting in the pub. All of those scenes feel as vivid as if I'd watched a film of them. And that knack is so rare. The same, actually, with 101 Dalmatians. the houses in that, the meals in that, all feel very vivid.
Gosh, I've not read 100 More Dalmatians in the longest time.
It's worth rereading. I think I read that during lockdown, and I remembered it very vividly anyway, but it does bear an adult reread in a way that not all children's fiction does.
I do. I haven't read it yet because I got it as a gift for my husband, who read I Kept the Castle as an adult man for the very first time in lockdown and just fell in love with it.
I want Dale's one-word review of it.
Producer Dale, what is your one-word review of I Kept the Castle?
One word? Fabulous.
Fabulous, he says.
Good word. I'm on it. Yeah, I agree.
I think it's the first volume of her memoir, Look Back With Love.
I have never read her memoir. You'll have to report
back. It's
about
40 quid on A-Books, which is annoying, but I will report back and let you know. I was very, very lucky to get as a Christmas gift Henrietta Murray's memoir called Henrietta. Ooh. And I read it all day on Christmas Day, and I'd wanted that book for ages, ever since I read The Oral History of the Colony Room. And apparently it's quite easy to pick up until that Maggie Hamblin documentary, and then suddenly the prices shot up.
I would really like to read that as well. I will look out.
Or maybe I can set up sort of some a tiny, tiny reading room.
You need a little sort of circulating library.
I mean, it's again what you were saying about sidelong glances. So the Colony Room book, which I can picture it. It's called Tales from the Colony Room. And so it's really mostly about Francis Bacon's Soho, I guess. And, you know, bits of Freud and those sort of 50s, 60s, and then we're going to New York. Oh, Olivia, it is the greatest fun. It gets very sad at the end. But it's an oral history, and everyone's contradicting each other, and everyone's bitching about each
other.
I mean, oral history just, you know, skips along.
I'm going to buy it. That sounds brilliant.
It's the best. And Henrietta turns up, and she's this sort of wildly sexy, sort of gaudy, boozy beauty with, you know, everyone's lover. And she's a sort of this icon of the Soho scene. And her memoir is so wild and fascinating and fulsome that that's like half a chapter of it. And she's doing all, she's just sort of, you know, in a motorbike and sidecar and going off to communes and, you know, living in sort of beautiful gypsy caravans. And she becomes, she gets very into dexedrine for a point. And then, and it's really, and she sobers up at the very end. It's really, really moving.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. I'm going to look it up right now.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been really, really lovely to speak to you.
That was lovely.
Huge thanks to Olivia. Everybody is published by Pan Macmillan and out now. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Thank you so much for spending this time with us, and we hope you enjoyed listening to this conversation as much as we did. You can follow us at YBooked on social media, look out for book recommendations, words of wisdom from old guests and occasional shelfies. We love it when you share the podcast with your friends. Thanks so much to everyone who's left us a 5-star review. It helps other people to discover us and discover new books. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Olivia at acast.com/booked and check out her selection in our bookshop on bookshop.org. For now, I leave you with this from Nora Ephron. There is something called the rapture of the deep, and it refers to what happens when a deep sea diver spends too much time at the bottom of the ocean and can't tell which way is up. When he surfaces, he's liable to have a condition called bends, where the body can't adapt to oxygen levels in the atmosphere. All of this happens to me when I surface from a great book. See you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.